sick of sin, if you could hear at every jolt the blood come gargling from the froth-corrupted lungs, obscene as cancer, bitter as the cud, of vile, incurable sores on innocent tongues, my friend, you would not tell with such high zest to children ardent for some desperate glory the old lie, dulce et decorum est, pro patria mori. Thank you.
You are listening to Earthwatch on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. We welcome your comments, leaks, and suggestions with an email to your host, rknight@wbai.org. That's rknight@wbai.org. And for Earthwatch, I'm Robert Knight in New York.
People say I'm crazy, doing what I'm doing. They give me all kinds of warnings, save me from ruin. And when I say that I'm okay, well, they look at me kind of strange. But surely you're not happy. Now you no longer play the game. People say I'm lazy, dreaming my life away. Well, they give me all kinds of advice designed to enlighten me. Tell them that I'm doing fine, watching the shadows on the wall. Oh, don't you miss the big time, boy, you're no longer on the ball. I'm just sitting here making the wheels go round and round, and rock the Boston Road. No longer riding on the just have to let it go. People asking questions, lost in confusion. Well, I tell them there's no problem, only solution. Well, they shake their heads and look at me as if I've lost my mind. I tell them there's no hurry, I'm just sitting here doing time. I'm just sitting here watching the wheels go round and round. I really love to watch them roll. No longer riding on the
And here I thought I had such a nice segue all set up, but for some reason I see the problem. Okay. For some reason, the player that I choose, I did such a nice cross-seg with John there. Well, Robert playing John, as it were. And, you know, the howl of the wolf would just go perfectly. Perfectly. But the volume on the particular player I choose, VLC, for some reason, the default is to turn it off. So in your mind, think of those last notes that Lennon had, and cross segue in your head to this.
Ooh.
good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weeknight, Wednesday night program, really. Celebrating science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, there's a hole in the city, read for you by Richard Wells, the whole thing this time. Stay tuned.
Hey, I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. I'm not going to tease this out. Watching Riddick is a lot like spending 2 hours up Nietzsche's butt. I'm not particularly against the whole Übermensch gambit in storytelling. Done right, with enough acknowledgement of how silly the thing can be, there can be fun in the absurdity of watching a master of all men overcoming every obstacle thrown his way. But given that Riddick, the character played by Vin Diesel, started as a more identifiably human antihero in the small-scale science fiction survival thriller Pitch Black, his elevation to swaggering demigod, able to outlast, outthink, and outbattle his adversaries whatever challenges they throw his way, gets wearing after a while. I will say this, director David Toohey, who also wrote the script for Riddick, has wisely backed off the bloated Robert E. Howard pastiche he created for The Chronicles of Riddick, the previous film featuring the character. Things are much simpler and more stripped down this time around. The setup is that Riddick is stranded on a deserted and quite hostile planet and lures two groups of bounty hunters down with the intent of stealing one of their spaceships, all before a mammoth storm front brings on an onslaught of giant scorpion-like predators. Clean, understandable concept, that's a good thing. We get two sets of squabbling hunters, one scruffy and not particularly observant of societal scruples, headed up by Jordi Moya, the other more efficient and maybe more honorable, led by Matt Nabel, and also incorporating Katie Sackhoff as a badass lesbian, which, by the way, doesn't exempt her from a shower sequence. We get some suspense and action as Riddick works some mind games against the group and thins out a few of the weaker members of the herd. But we also get a weird kind of structuring to the film, with the first act devoted to Riddick's lone survival on the planet, after which he disappears for something on the order of about a half hour, while we meet the bounty hunters and Riddick begins messing with their minds, followed in the last act by what is essentially a condensed remake of Pitch Black. It feels somewhat slapdash, as if the whole survival thing was appended to the beginning because, you know, the film is called Riddick, and the film should actually have started with the bounty hunters and their discovering how outmatched they are by the stealthy fugitive. And then, yes, there is that whole Riddick as Superman thing. It gets tired, to the point where when there's a sequence where a chained Riddick tells one of the bounty hunters that he will be killed in 5 seconds, there's no suspense to the threat or thrill to the event, even though the sequence itself is choreographed well. If your character is that infallible, if his opponents are that overmatched, where's the fun? Toohey has made the right choice with Riddick the movie. taking away the epic scale and keeping things trim. But there's still this attempt to make Riddick the character mythic, when he plays better as just a human. And the attempt to reignite the thrill of the very good Pitch Black by delivering a Capsule remake at the end feels cursory and unsatisfying. On the basis of Pitch Black, I know Tui can do good stuff, but Riddick doesn't quite reach that bar. It's taking the right steps. It needed to take more. I'm Dan Persons. Check out more about the worlds of fantastic film at Cinefantastique Online over at cfqonline.com.
Not .com, but .com. Which I guess with WBAI would make us at WBAI.org. It would be only fitting. ARG is probably closer to it, but it's spelled O-R-G, so we'll stick with ORG. And this is Hour of the Wolf over WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifico Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. And this is something that is becoming as close to an annual tradition as I can make it, although the last time for the whole thing was 2 years ago. Rick Bowes, Richard Bowes, by Byline, who was on this show, in fact, just a few weeks ago, helping us beg for money. And after that, actually, simply as the guest. And then after that, last night, was one of our two readers at the New York Review of Science Fiction readings. Rick wrote in 2005 a story that, as far as I'm concerned, is still the best fictional uptake on 9/11. And, you know, now I know Tom Pynchon has a new novel that deals with this, but hey, I like Rick Bowes. And he did this here for us. So we're going to listen to this whole thing. BAI has played this on both the 5th anniversary and the 10th anniversary. Prime time, as a matter of fact. And I want to thank them for that. And this is probably the second or third time that I'm playing this on Hour of the Wolf itself. Third time. And then once it was on Cat Radio Cafe, Janet Coleman and David Dozer's program, which I'm given to understand, by the way, I will be host of for 1 week in October. So, but I have to talk to Janet about that. But she called me up just as I was running out the door yesterday to go to the reading and set everything up. And it was, I can only talk for a second because we're usually on, you know, when we start talking, it's usually on, well, for quite a while. And, no, it was like, hi, Janet, I can't talk now. Okay, can you do Cat Radio Cafe in October? Yep. Bye. Click. So we have to work out all them details. But, so where the hell have you been, Lister? Go ahead and you're on microphone if you're going to talk.
They had a warrant out for my arrest.
Well, yeah, what else is new?
in racist North Carolina. You see, 4 years ago on the beach of Ocracoke.
Racist away. And, may I say, by the way, thoroughly, UNC, uh-huh. which I take it is the University of North Carolina,
right.
just added famed science fiction writer Orson Scott Card to their board.
Great.
Well, not really.
Not really.
I mean, now, I really love Orson Scott Card's fiction. Mm-hmm. And his novel Ender's Game is opening as a big $25 billion movie in November, or very early November, starring Harrison Ford and all-star cast. You know, we're not playing this up. But the last time I interviewed Scott, which was about 2 or 3 years ago, mm-hmm. I went to his blog and discovered that he was going all out to defeat Proposition 8 in California, forbidding, you know, and trying, he was trying to forbid gay marriage.
Really?
And spending vast personal sums of money, blogging, doing all this, and then making such outrageous statements. He was going to be working on a Superman comic, and mm-hmm. they just distanced them. So they let him go. They said, thank you, no thank you. The movie company that is putting out Ender's Game, mm-hmm. you know, is not calling this Orson Scott Card's Ender's Game.
What are they calling it?
Just Ender's Game. You know, they're, in other words, they're distancing uh-huh. themselves from this writer, not just because he has particular opinions. Many science fiction writers, good science fiction writers, have had odious views on life and people and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I will say this, in the case of Scott Card, over the long run, mm-hmm. it really does not affect his fiction. But he has been so egregious in what he is doing. And since the whole post-DOPA thing where mm-hmm. no state can declare gay marriage illegal, mm-hmm. he's taken on new things and said, I don't even recall them right now, but just said such outrageous things as to really make people want to wince.
Wait a minute. Is he suicidal?
No, not at all. He's just... Meshuggah.
He's just...
There's a medical term.
He's just...
There's a medical term. You can look it up in any Yiddish dictionary. He's meshuggah. And he... and I mean, what he's really doing... I have to question this. Because as far as I'm concerned, what he's doing... The best book that he's ever written, as far as I'm concerned, is the sequel to Ender's Game called Speaker for the Dead. Mm-hmm. Brilliant, wonderful, great, great novel. Hmm. Ender's Game is a fix-up of a novella, a good novella, very good novella. Yeah. And as a novel, it's quite decent. But even, you know, and there are people, I was at a panel at ReaderCon in July, and was actually being moderated by my partner, Barbara. And there was a woman, I have to stop to get her name right, Yoon Ha Lee is her name, an American writer, but of, I believe, Korean descent, I think. But anyway, the question, and it was about, you know, not just guilty pleasures, but, you know, what do you do when favorite works of yours are just politically wrong? And this woman, who is, you know, obviously nobody's... right winger, mm-hmm. if you know what I mean. Sure. She's a very open-minded person, said, you will take my copy of Ender's Game out of my cold hands. You know, heart and, you know, so, okay. So his fiction is good. Mm-hmm. But what he's doing, as far as I'm concerned, by making such, going out of his way to get mm-hmm. quoted and spending money to lobby for legislation and stuff like this, is he's making sure that they're not going to make a sequel. Oh. And that's a shame, because he's artistically very good. Uh-huh. I mean, I listen to Wagner. I love Wagner. He's one of the worst anti-Semites, and there is a certain amount of anti-Semitism in the first act of the third opera of the Ring Cycle, although you can stage it carefully and avoid that, mm-hmm. which recent productions have done. Mm-hmm. But there's no need to let this stuff get in people's way mm-hmm. Of their reading pleasure. Now, a person who used to be on WBAI on Monday nights.
Used to.
He created a show called the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. And his name was Peter Lanborn Wilson. Before Bill Weinberg was doing the show.
He started that?
Yes, that was his show.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, just like Margot Adler started Hour of the Wolf.
Right.
Peter Lanborn Wilson, himself a brilliant science fiction writer, mm-hmm. under the pseudonym Hakim Bey.
Hakim
Bey, B-E-Y, in which he wrote a novel available for free download called The Autonomous Zone, or Taz, T-A-Z, for the Autonomous Zone. He's also edited a few science fiction anthologies, and he wrote a great radio drama for us in the 70s called The Rider at the Spirit Bell. And he started a letter feud, a few, you know, what online today they would call a flame war, with Scott Card. Now Peter's gay, and he protested about Scott Card's fiction. And he said, here you have the story Ender's Game, which is basically about a, I forget in the story just how old he is, but he's a young boy. And he's playing video games, war video games. And the reveal of the short story and the novel. But, of course, we know this going into the movie, so there's no spoilers here. Is that he's not just playing a video game, he's running the war. And Speaker for the Dead takes place so many years later, showing remorse. So anyhow, so you have this young boy being put through various tortuous things. Then he's got, but becoming a better person for it in the end. Then he had another book, I think it was Spellsinger, in which a boy is turned into a castrato.
What year was this?
Mid-80s.
Okay.
Mid-80s, I would say. Yeah, it sounds right. Maybe late 80s. And as a castrato, giving this beautiful singing voice, but being basically tortured, his life is improved. And then there's Seventh Son, the Alvin series of books. And guess what theme can be found in at least the first book of that series?
What theme?
And so Peter was saying, we have a bit of a problem here in that I can recognize somebody who has gay pederast problems when I see one.
Really?
And Scott, of course, highly objected to this. Now, this was not so much on the air as it was in the fanzines. Before, you know, there were online wars. There were wars in fanzines, science fiction fanzines, and this goes back to the 1930s, this, this kind of warring of words, the kind of stuff that you see on the internet every day. We did it first. Yes, it was us, the science fiction people, and that's sadly true. And you know, I didn't know quite what to think, because I knew Scott, and I didn't quite believe this. And but I know that Peter Lanborn Wilson is a schmatty. He knows his stuff. And yeah, he called it. And today, it would seem to be apparent that Peter had, well, scored points. So, you know, what I'll do now is I'll say we're about to hear a reading. By a Lambda Award-winning science fiction writer, Rick Bose. Lambda Award being Best Science Fiction with Gay Themes. And aside from the fact that it's simply a brilliant story, no matter what. And actually, this was, story wasn't what won the Lambda Award. It was his novel, just re-released novel, Minions of the Moon. But this story has, well, some gay element to it, but it's irrelevant to the story. Other than, it's relevant to the characters within the story. And we can talk about that and what I was talking about with Scott Card and Ender's Game after we hear this reading.
And also, can you talk to me about the new Robocop movie?
No, I know absolutely nothing about it. I've seen the trailer. And it looks spiffier than the first one. But, you know, the first
one, I enjoyed the first one.
I thought the first one was a hoot.
Really?
It was a comedy.
It was fun.
It was intended to be a comedy. I'll buy that for a dollar. I mean, Peter Verhaeven, I believe is the correct pronunciation of his, his name is Dutch filmmaker. He, and with Starship Troopers as well, his tongue was firmly in cheek, you know. And given that it was Heinlein, talk about, you know, a person who was so far to the right that he came out the other side, to the left. Uh-huh. And libertarians deified Heinlein, which mm-hmm. Heinlein did not care for, by the way. And although he liked being deified by anybody. Verhaeven saw RoboCop as a funny thing. And the special effects were fine, but it was never for its day. Mm-hmm. Today, they look clunky in comparison, but I don't care because it's the original movie.
Right.
And it is what it is. I just don't see, unless, we'll see if they have the same wit that the original film had. So it's one of those movies to which I have to say, WTF, why?
Why?
Why TF are they remaking that? Will they make it look better? Yeah, there's no question. The trailer looks great.
Really?
Yeah. The movie I'm most interested in seeing, the science fiction film mm-hmm. so far of the year, is going to come out, I think, near the end of this month, and it's called Gravity.
Wow.
And it's directed by Alfonso Cuarón. Who is a great? Where is he from? Cuarón,
Mexico.
I think it might be Mexico. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I know Robert Rodriguez is Mexican.
That's supposed to be a good film,
or at least South American, if not Central American, if not Mexican.
Right. That's supposed to be a good film.
Oh, I'm looking forward. I'm
definitely
going to
see
it. It stars Sandra Bullock and George Clooney. Mm-hmm. And I am told that pretty much the whole movie takes place in space, not in a ship. Yeah. It's two people who, on an accident of the interstellar space station, get cast off, that's and cool. are hurtling toward Earth.
That's cool.
And that's the entire movie.
Mm.
And... Cuarón, as far as I am concerned, just discussing his science fiction and fantasy and not, what's it, Mama E, I can't give the proper pronunciation, but it's a film with a Spanish title, mm-hmm. which won the Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film, but probably should have won for Best Film.
Mm-hmm.
Cuarón took the Harry Potter movies mm-hmm. and turned them into adult films. Mm. The first two films were fun, mm-hmm. but they were by the numbers children's films. And I like by the numbers children's films. But when he made Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, mm-hmm. he brought a deep intelligence to the Harry Potter series that had not been there before.
Interesting.
And then he made the movie Children of Men, starring Clive Owen and Michael Caine, and is a very dark, very heartwarming at the same time science fiction movie,
mm-hmm.
Near future SF film.
Wow.
In which basically there are no children. The youngest person on the planet is about 41 years old.
Wow.
And the attempt, why there are no children is what emerges, and the attempt of some people underground mm-hmm. to save a pregnant woman. Which basically represents saving mankind. It would be like, keeping WBAI alive.
Breastfeeding WBAI.
And that, yeah, right. And that would... and that was a brilliant, intelligent, sophisticated, not typical American mindset like Riddick mm-hmm. that we just heard a review of, science fiction movie. So here's another with Sandra Bullock and George Clooney. Clooney now chooses his movies very well. Good. Bullock is an interesting actress.
Yeah.
And... that, I think, The Hobbit is overblown and it's only part two of three. This Cuarón film, I think, is going to be the best science fiction film of this year.
Yeah. Great.
Certainly the most interesting, the best attempt at real science fiction.
Now, can we go to the reading?
I think we really ought to. Right. Wasted enough time. But hopefully people have heard this. Hopefully you will be hearing it again.
Good.
And it is worth re-listening to. You remember Rick Bose.
Yes, indeed.
The first show that I had in this time slot, he was the guest. And he saw you and said, he's the god of love. That's exactly what he did. That's exactly what he did.
Thanks.
So now Rick's upset that he's not here.
Yeah.
Because he almost came here tonight.
Well, he missed out.
Yeah. Okay, but he didn't miss out. He's listening at home, but he doesn't get the visuals. There's no camera in here. I just noticed.
Hi, Rick.
Yeah. No camera. The camera's gone.
Now I can take off my clothes.
If it weren't on, you'd do that anyway.
Right,
anyway.
Right.
So... all of this levity. Well, it's not a, you know, yes, it's a serious story. There's a hole in the city, but it is also, despite its being a 9/11 story and a story about other New York tragedies, mm-hmm. including the shirt waste factory fire, and the sinking of the General Slocum. Mm-hmm. Which had all the German immigrants aboard,
in
which all hands were lost. It was like, 900, 600 or something people died.
Right.
And this story involves all of those things, plus 9/11. And having said that, it's a heartfelt and in its way very warm story.
Mm-hmm.
So without further ado,
here it goes.
Here it goes.
There's a Hole in the City by Richard Bose, read by the author. Wednesday, 9/12/01. On the evening of the day after the towers fell, I was waiting by the barricades on Houston Street and LaGuardia Place for my friend Mags to come up from Soho and have dinner with me. On the skyline, not 2 miles to the south, the pillars of smoke wavered slightly. But the creepily beautiful weather of September 11th still held, and the wind blew in from the northeast. In Greenwich Village, the air was crisp and clean, with just a touch of fall about it. I'd spent the last day and a half looking at pictures of burning towers. One of the frustrations of that time was that there was so little most of us could do anything about anything or for anyone. Downtown streets were empty of all traffic except emergency vehicles. The West and East Villages, from 14th Street to Houston, were their own separate zone. Pedestrians needed identification, proving they lived or worked there, in order to enter. The barricades consisted of blue wooden police horses and a couple of unmarked vans thrown across LaGuardia Place. Behind them were a couple of cops, a few auxiliary police, and one or two guys in civilian clothes, with IDs of some kind pinned to their shirts. All of them looked tired, subdued by events. At the barricades was a small crowd, ones like me waiting for friends from neighborhoods to the south, ones without proper identification, waiting for confirmation so they could continue on into Soho, people who just wanted to be outside near other people in those days of sunshine and shock. Once in a while, each of us would look up at the columns of smoke that hung in the downtown sky, then look away again. A family approached, a middle-aged cop behind the barricades. The group consisted of a man, a woman, a little girl being led by the hand, a child being carried. All were blondish and wore shorts and casual tops. The parents seemed pleasant but serious people in their early 30s, professionals. They could have been tourists, but that day the city was empty of tourists. The man said something, and I heard the cop say loudly, "You want to go where?" "Down there," the man gestured at the columns. He indicated the children. "We want them to see." It sounded as if he couldn't imagine this appeal not working. Everyone stared at the family. "No ID, no passage," said the cop, and turned his back on them. The pleasant expressions on the parents' faces faded. They looked indignant, like a maitre d' had lost their reservations. She led one kid, he carried another, as they turned west, probably headed for another checkpoint. "They wanted those little kids to see Ground Zero?" a woman who knew the cop asked. "Are they out of their minds?" "Looters," he replied. "That's my guess." He picked up his walkie-talkie to call the checkpoints ahead of them. Mags appeared just then, looking a bit frayed. When you've known someone for as long as I've known her, the tendency is not to see the changes, to think you both look about the same as when you were kids. But kids don't have gray hair, and their bodies aren't thick the way bodies get in their late 50s. Their kisses aren't perfunctory. Their conversation doesn't include curt little nods that indicate something is understood. We walked in the middle of the streets because we could. Couldn't sleep much last night, I said. Because of the quiet, she said. No planes. I kept listening for them. I haven't been sleeping anyway. I was supposed to be in housing court today, but the courts are shut until further notice. I said, notice how, with only the ones who live here allowed in, the South Village is all Italians and hippies. Like 1965, all over again. She and I had been in contact more in the past few months than we had in a while. Memories of love and indifference that we shared had made close friendship an on-and-off thing for the last 30-something years. Earlier in 2001, at the end of an affair, I'd surrendered a rent-stabilized apartment for a cash settlement and bought a tiny co-op in the South Village. Mags lived as she had for years in a run-down building on the fringes of Soho. So we saw each other again. I write, obviously, but she never read anything I published, which bothered me. On the other hand, she worked on and off for various activist leftist foundations, and I was mostly uninterested in that. Mags was in the midst of a classic New York work and housing trouble. Currently, she was on unemployment, and her landlord wanted to get her out of her apartment so he could co-op her building. The money offer he'd made wasn't bad, but she wanted things to stay as they were. It struck me that what was youthful about her was that she had never settled into her life, still stood at the edge. Lots of the village restaurants weren't open. The owners couldn't or wouldn't come into the city. Angelina's on Thompson Street was, though, because Angelina lives just a couple of doors down from her place. She was busy serving tables herself, since the waiters couldn't get in from where they lived. Later, I had reason to try and remember. The place was full, but very quiet. People murmured to each other, as Mags and I did. Nobody I knew was there. In the background, Rasvigi's ancient airs and dances played. Like the Blitz, someone said. Never the same again, said a person at another table. There isn't even any place to volunteer to help, a third person said. I don't drink anymore, but Mags, as I remember, had a carafe of wine. Phone service had been spotty, but we had managed to exchange bits of what we had seen. Mrs. Pirelli, I said, the Italian lady upstairs from me. I told you she had a heart attack watching the smoke and flames. On television, her son worked in the World Trade Center, and she was sure he had burned to death. Getting an ambulance wasn't possible yesterday morning, but the guys at the little fire barn around the corner were there waiting to be called, I guess. They took her to St. Vincent's in the chief's car. Right about then, her son came up the street, his pinstripe suit with a hole burned on the shoulder, soot on his face, wild-eyed, but alive. Today they say she's doing fine. I waited, spearing clams, twirling linguine. Mags had a deeper and darker story to tell, a dip into the subconscious. Before I'd known her and afterwards, Mags had a few rough brushes with mental disturbance. Back in college, where we first met, I envied her that, wished I had something as dramatic to talk about. I've been thinking about what happened last night. She'd already told me some of this. The downstairs bell rang, which scared me. But with phone service being bad, it could have been a friend, someone who needed to talk. I looked out the window. The street was empty, dead, like I'd never seen it. Nothing but papers blowing down the street. You know how, every time you see a scrap of paper now, you think it's from the Trade Center? For a minute, I thought I saw something move. But when I looked again, there was nothing. I didn't ring the buzzer, but it seemed someone upstairs did, because I heard this noise, a rustling in the hall. When I went to the door and lifted the spy hole, this figure stood there on the landing, looking around like she was lost. She wore a dress, long and torn, and a blouse, what I realized was a shirt waist, turn-of-the-century clothes. When she turned towards my door, I saw her face. It was bloody, smashed like she had taken a big jump or fall. I gasped, and then she was gone. And you woke up? No, I tried to call you. But the phones were all screwed up. She had fallen, but not from 100 stories. Anyway, she wasn't from here and now. Mags had emptied the carafe. I remember that she just had ordered a salad and didn't eat that. But Angelina brought a fresh carafe. I told Mags about the family at the barricades. There's a hole in the city, said Mags. That night, after we had parted, I lay in bed, watching but not seeing some old movie on TV, avoiding any channel with any kind of news. And the buzzer sounded. I jumped up and went to view the screen. On the empty streets downstairs, a man, wild-eyed, disheveled, glared directly into the camera. Phone service was not reliable. Cops were not in evidence in the neighborhood right then. I froze and didn't buzz him in. But, as in Mag's building, someone else did. I bolted my door, watched at the spy hole, listened to the footsteps, slow and uncertain. When he came into sight on the second floor landing, he looked around and said in a hoarse voice, "Hello, sorry, but I can't find my mom's front door key." Only then did I unlock the door, open it, and ask her exhausted son how Mrs. Pirelli was doing. "Fine," he said, "getting great treatment. St. Vincent was geared up for thousands of casualties. Instead," he shrugged. "Anyway, she thanks all of you. Me too." In fact, I hadn't done much. We said good night, and he shuffled on upstairs to where he was crashing in his mother's place. Thursday, 9:13. By September of 2001, I had worked an information desk in the university library for almost 30 years. I live right around the corner from Washington Square, and just before 10 a.m. on Thursday, I went out for work. The Muslim-run souvlaki stand across the street was still closed. Its owner and workers gone since Tuesday morning. All the little falafel shops in the South Village were shut and dark. On my way to work, I saw a three-legged rat running not too quickly down the middle of McDougal Street. I decided not to think about portents and symbolism. The big TV setup in the library atrium was still showing the towers falling again and again, but now they also showed workers digging in the flaming wreckage at Ground Zero. Like the day before, I was the only one in my department who had made it in. The librarians lived too far away. Even Marco, the student assistant, wasn't around. Marco lived in a dorm downtown right near the World Trade Center. Then had been evacuated with nothing more than a few books and the clothes they were wearing. Tuesday had been very upset. I'd given him Kleenex, made him take deep breaths, got him to call his mother back in California. I'd even walked him over to the gym where the university was putting up the displaced students. Tuesday morning, all of the computer stations around the information desk were occupied. Students sat furiously typing email and devouring incoming messages, but the intensity had slackened since 9/11. The girls no longer sniffed and dabbed at tears as they read. The boys didn't jump up and come back from the restrooms red-eyed and saying they had allergies. I said good morning and sat down. The kids hadn't spoken much to me in the last few days, had no questions to ask, but all of them from time to time would turn and look to make sure I was still there. If I got up to leave the desk, they'd ask when I was coming back. Some of the back windows had a downtown view. The pillar of smoke wavered. The wind was changing. The phone rang. Reception had improved. Most calls went through. When I answered, a voice, tight and tense, blurted out, "Jenny Levine was who I saw. She was 19 years old in 1911 when the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory burned. She lived in my building with her family 90 years ago. Her spirit found its way home, but the inside of my building has changed so much that she didn't recognize it." "Hi, Mags," I said. "Want to come up here and have lunch?" A couple of hours later, we were in a small dining hall normally used by faculty on the west side of the square. The university, with food on hand and not enough people to eat it, had thrown opens at cafeterias and dining halls to anybody with a university identification. We could even bring a friend if we cared to. Now that I looked, Mags had tension lines around her eyes, and hair could have used some tending. But we were all of us a little ragged in those days of sun and horror. People kept glancing downtown, even if they were inside and not near a window. The Indian lady who ran the facility greeted us, thanked us for coming. I had a really nice gumbo, fresh avocado salad, a soothing pudding. The place was half empty, and conversations again were muted. I told Mags about Mrs. Pirelli's son the night before. She looked up from her plate, unsmiling, said, "I did not imagine Jenny Levine," and cleared that subject.
Take it from the Indian lady who ran the facility.
Okay.
Paragraph before.
"The Indian lady who ran the facility greeted us, thanked us for coming. I had a really nice gumbo, French avocado salad, a soothing pudding. The place was half empty, and conversations again were muted. I told Mags about Mrs. Pirelli's son the night before. She looked up from her plate, unsmiling, said, "I did not imagine Jenny Levine," and closed that subject. Afterwards, she and I stood on Washington Place before the university building that had once housed the sweatshop called the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory. At the end of the block, a long convoy of olive green army trucks rolled silently down Broadway. Mag said, "On the afternoon of March 25, 1911, 146 young women burned to death on this site. Fire broke out in a pile of rags. The door to the roof was locked. The fire ladders couldn't reach the eighth floor. The girls burned." Her voice tightened as she said, "They jumped and were smashed on the sidewalk. Many of them, most of them, lived right around here, in the renovated tenements we live in now. It's like those planes blew a hole in the city, and Jenny Levine returned through it." "Easy, honey. The university has grief counseling available. I think I'm going. You want me to see if I can get you in?" It sounded idiotic even as I said it. We had walked back to the library. "There are others," she said. "Kids all blackened and bloated and wearing old-fashioned clothes. I woke up early this morning and couldn't go back to sleep. I got up and walked around here and over in the East Village." "Jesus," I said. "Jeffrey has come back, too. I know it. Mags, don't." This was something we hadn't talked about in a long time. Once there were three, and Jeffrey was the third. He was younger than either of us by a couple of years, at a time of life when that still seemed a major difference. We called him Lord Jeff because we said we were all a bit better than the world around us. We joked that he was our child, a little family cemented by desire and drugs.
Take it from "we called him Lord Jeff."
We called him Lord Jeff because he said we were all a bit better than the world around us. We joked that he was our child, a little family cemented by desire and drugs. The three of us were all so young, just out of school and in the city. Then jealousy and the hard realities of addiction began to tear us apart. Each had to find his or her own survival. Mags and I made it. As it turned out, Jeff wasn't built for the long haul. He was 21. We were all just kids, ignorant and reckless. As I made excuses in my mind, Mags gripped my arm. "He'll want to find us," she said. Chilled, I watched her walk away and wondered how long she had been coming apart and why I hadn't noticed. Back at work, Marco waited for me. He was part Filipino, a bit of a little wise-ass who dressed in downtown black. But that was the week before. Today he was a woebegone refugee in oversized flip-flops, a magenta sweatshirt, and gym shorts, all of which had been made for someone bigger and more buff. "How's it going?" "It sucks. My stuff is all downtown where I don't know if I can ever get it. They have these crates in the gym, toothbrushes, bras, Bic razors, but never what you need. Everything from boxer shorts on out, and nothing is ever the right size. I gave my clothes in to be cleaned and they didn't bring them back. Now I look like a clown. They have all of us sleeping on cots in the basketball courts. I lay there all last night staring up at the ceiling with 100 other guys. Some of them snore. One was yelling in his sleep. I don't want to take a shower with a bunch of guys staring at me." He told me all this while not looking my way, but I understood what he was asking. I expected this was going to be a pain, but given that I couldn't seem to do much for Mags, I thought maybe it would be a distraction to do what I could for someone else. "Want to take a shower at my place? Crash on my couch? Could I, please?" So I took a break, brought him around the corner to my apartment, put sheets on the daybed. He was in the shower when I went back to work. That evening when I got home, he woke up. When I went out to take a walk, he tagged along. We stood at the police barricades at Houston Street and 6th Avenue and watched the traffic coming up from the World Trade Center site. An ambulance with one side smashed and a squad car with its roof crushed were hauled up 6th Avenue on the back of a huge flatbed truck. NYPD buses were full of guys returning from Ground Zero, hollow-eyed, filthy. Crowds of Greenwich villagers gathered on the sidewalks, clapped and cheered, yelled, "We love our firemen. We love our cops." The firehouse on 6th Avenue had taken a lot of casualties when the tower fell. The place was locked and empty. We looked at the flowers and the wreaths on the doors, the signs with faces of the firefighters who hadn't returned, and the messages to the brave men of these companies who gave their lives defending us. The plume of smoke downtown rolled in the twilight, buffeted about by shifting winds. The breeze brought with it for the first time the acrid smoke that would be with us for weeks afterwards. Officials said it was the stench of burning concrete. I believed, as did everyone else, that part of what we breathed was the ashes of the ones who had burned to death that Tuesday. It started to drivel. Mark stuck close to me as we walked back. Hip 20-year-olds do not normally hang out with guys almost three times their age. This kid was very scared. Bleecker Street looked semi-abandoned.
Could you take it again from "it started to drizzle"?
It started to drizzle. Marco stuck close to me as we walked back. Hip 20-year-olds do not normally hang out with guys almost three times their age. This kid was very scared. Bleecker Street looked semi-abandoned, with lots of stores and restaurants still closed. The ones that were open were mostly empty at 9 in the evening. "If I buy you a six-pack, you promise to drink all of it?" He indicated he would. At home, Marco asked to use the phone. He called people he knew on campus looking for a spare dorm room and spoke in whispers to a girl named Eloise. In between calls, he worked the computer. I played a little Lady Day, some Ray Charles, a bit of Haydn, stared at the TV screen. The president had pulled out of his funk and was coming to New York the next day. In the next room, the phone rang. "No, my name's Marco," I heard him say. "He's letting me stay here." I knew who it was before he came in and whispered. She asked if I was Lord Jeff. "Hi, Mags," I said. She was calling from somewhere, with walkie-talkies and sirens in the background. "Those kids I saw and asked a place," she said, her voice clear and crazed. "The ones all burned and drowned? They were on the General Slocum when it caught fire." "The kids you saw and asked a place all burned and drowned," I asked. Then I remembered our conversation earlier. "On June 15th, 1904, the biggest disaster in New York City history, until now, the East Village was once called Little Germany. Tens of thousands of Germans with their own meeting halls, churches, beer gardens. They had a Sunday excursion, mainly for the kids, on a steamship, the General Slocum, a floating fire trap. When it burst into flames, there were no lifeboats. The crew and the captain panicked. By the time they got to a dock, over 1,000 were dead, burned, drowned. When a hole got blown in the city, they came back looking for their homes." The connection started to dissolve into static. "Where are you, Mags?" "Ground Zero. It smells like burning sulfur. Have you seen Jeffrey yet?" she shouted into her phone. "Jeffrey is dead, Mags. It's all the horror and tension that's doing this to you. There's no hole. Cops and firemen and brokers, all smashed and charred, are walking around down here."
Take it from Jeffrey is dead.
"Jeffrey is dead, Mags. It's all the horror and tension that's doing this to you. There's no hole. Cops and firemen and brokers, all smashed and charred, are walking around down here." At that point, sirens screamed in the background. Men were yelling. The connection faded. "Mags, give me your number. Call me back," I yelled. Then there was nothing but static, followed by a weak dial tone. I hung up and waited for the phone to ring again. After a while, I realized Marco was standing looking at me, slugging down beer. "She saw those kids? I saw them, too. Tuesday night, I was too jumpy to even lie down on the goddamn cot. I snuck out with my friend Terry. We walked around. The kids were there, in old historical clothes, covered with mud and seaweed, and their faces all black and gone. That's why I couldn't sleep last night." "You talked to the counselors?" I asked. He drained the bottle. "Yeah, but they didn't want to hear what I wanted to talk about. But with me? You're crazy, you understand." The silence outside was broken by a jet engine. We both flinched. No planes had flown over Manhattan since the ones that had smashed into the towers on Tuesday morning. Then I realized what it was. "The Air Force," I said, "making sure it's safe for Mr. Bush's visit." "Who's Mags? Who's Lord Jeff?" So I told him a bit of what had gone on in that strange, lost country, the 1960s, the naivete that led to meth and junk. I described the wonder of that unknown land, the three-way union. Our problem, I guess, was that instead of a real menage, each member was obsessed with only one of the others. "Okay," he said. "You're alive. Mags is alive. What happened to Jeff?" When things were breaking up, Jeff got caught in a drug sweep. He was being hauled downtown in the back of a police van. He cut his wrists and bled to death in the dark before anyone noticed. This did for me what speaking about the dead kids had maybe done for him. Each of us got talk about what bothered him without having to think about what the other said. Friday, 9:14. Friday morning, two queens walked by with their little dogs as Marco and I came out the door of my building. One said, "There isn't a fresh croissant in the entire village. It's like the siege of Paris. We'll all be reduced to eating rats." I murmured, "He's getting a little ahead of the story. Maybe first he should think about having an English muffin." "Or eating his yappy dog," said Marco. At that moment, the authorities opened the east and west villages between 14th and Houston Street to outside traffic. All these people whose cars had been stranded since Tuesday began to come into the neighborhood and drive them away. Delivery trucks started to appear on the narrow streets. In the library, the huge TV screens showed the activity at Ground Zero, the preparations for the president's visit. An elevator door opened and revealed a couple of refugee kids in their surplus gym clothes, clasped in a passion clinch. The computers around my information desk were still fully occupied, but the tension level had fallen. There was even a question or two about books and databases. I tried repeatedly to call Mags. All I got was the chilling message on her answering machine. In a staccato voice, it said, "This is Mags McConnell. There's a hole in the city, and I've turned this into a center for information about the victims Jenny Levine and Jeffrey Holborn. Anyone with information concerning the whereabouts of these two young people, please speak after the beep." I've left a few messages asking her to call. Then I called every half hour or so, hoping she'd pick up. I phoned mutual friends. Some were absent or unavailable. A couple were nursing grief of their own. No one had seen her recently. That evening, in the growing dark, lights flickered in Washington Square. Candles were given out. Candles were lighted with matches and bics and wick to wick. Various priests, ministers, rabbis, and shamans led flower-bearing, candlelit congregations down the street and into the park, where they joined the gathering vigil crowd. Marco had come by with his friend Terry, a kind of elfin kid who'd also had to stay at the gym. We went to this 9/11 vigil together. People addressed the crowd, gave impromptu elegies. There were prayers and a few songs. Then, by instinct or some plan I hadn't heard about, everybody started to move out of the park and flow in groups through the streets. We paused at street lamps that bore signs with pictures of pajama-clad families in suburban rec rooms on Christmas mornings. One face would be circled in red, and there would be a message like, "This is James Bolton, husband of Susan, father of Jimmy, Anna, and Sue. Last seen leaving his home in Far Rockaway at 7:30 a.m. on 9/11. This was followed by the name of the company, the floor of the Trade Center tower where he worked, phone and fax numbers, the email address, and the words, "If you have any information about where he is, please contact us." At each sign, someone would leave a lighted candle on a tin plate. Someone else would leave flowers. The doors of the little neighborhood fire rescue station were open. The truck and the command car were gone. The place was manned by retired firefighters with faces like old Irish and Italian character actors. A big picture of a fireman who had died was hung up beside the door. He was young, maybe 30. He and his wife, or maybe his girlfriend, smiled in front of a ski lodge. The picture was framed with children's drawings of firemen and fire trucks and fires, with condolences and novena cards. As we walked and the night progressed, the crowd got stretched out. We'd see clumps of candles ahead of us on the streets. It was Great Jones Street and the Bowery that suddenly were just the three of us and no traffic to speak of. When I turned to say maybe we should go home, I saw for a moment a tall guy staggering down the street with his face purple and his eyes bulging out. Then he was gone. Either Marco or Terry whispered, "Christ, he killed himself." And none of us said anything more. At some point in the evening, I had said Terry could spend the night in my apartment. He couldn't take his eyes off Marco, though Marco seemed not to notice. On our way home, way east on Bleecker Street, outside a bar that had been old even when I hung out there as a kid, I saw the poster. It was like a dozen others I'd seen that night, except it was in old-time black and white, and showed three kids with lots of hair and bad attitude, Mags and Jeffrey and me. Jeff's face was circled, and under it was written, "This is Jeffrey Holborn. If you have seen him since Tuesday, 9/11, please contact." And Mags had left her name and numbers. Even in the photo, I looked towards Jeffrey, who looked towards Mags, who looked towards me. I stared for just a moment before going on, but I knew that Marco had noticed. Saturday, 9:15. My tiny apartment was a crowded mess Saturday morning. Every towel I owned was wet. Every glass and mug was dirty. It smelled like a zoo. There were pizza crusts in the sink and a bag of beer cans at the front door. The night before, none of us had talked about ghosts. Marco and Terry had seriously discussed whether they would be drafted or would enlist. The idea of them in the army did not make me feel any safer. Saturday is a work day for me. Getting ready, I reminded myself that this would soon be over. The university had found all the refugee kids' dorm rooms on campus. Then the bell rang, and a young lady with a nose ring and bright red ringlets of hair appeared. Eloise was another refugee, though a much better organized one. She had brought bagels and my guest's laundry. Marcus seemed delighted to see her. That morning, all the restaurants and bars, the tattoo shops and massage parlors, were opening up. Even the Arab falafel shop owners had risked insults and death threats to ride the subway in from Queens and open their doors for business. At the library, the huge screens in the lobby were being taken down. A couple of students were borrowing books. One or two even had in-depth reference questions for me. When I finally worked up the courage to call Mags, all I got was the same message as before. Marco appeared, dressed in his own clothes and clearly feeling better. He hugged me. "You were great to take me in. It helped me even more," I told him. He paused, then asked, "That was you in the poster last night, wasn't it? You and Mags and Jeffrey." The kid was a bit uncanny. When I nodded, he said, "Thanks for talking about that." I was in a hurry when I went off duty Saturday evening. A friend had called, invited me to an impromptu survivors' party. In the days of the French Revolution, the Terror, that's what they called the soirees, at which people danced and drank all night, then went out at dawn to see which of their names were on the list of those to be guillotined. On 6th Avenue, a bakery that had very special cupcakes with devastating frosting was opening again. The avenue was clogged with honking, creeping traffic. A huge chunk of Lower Manhattan had been declared open that afternoon, and people were able to get the cars that had been stranded down there. The bakery was across the street from a Catholic church, and that afternoon in that place, a wedding was being held. As I came out with my cupcakes, the bride and groom, not real young, not very glamorous, but obviously happy, came out the door and posed on the steps for pictures. Traffic was at a standstill. People beeped. "Here comes the bride," leaned out their windows, applauded and cheered, all of us relieved to find this ordinary, normal thing taking place. Then I saw her on the other side of 6th Avenue. Mags was tramping along, staring straight ahead, a poster with a black and white photo hanging from a string around her neck. The crowd in front of the church parted for her. Mourners were sacred at that moment. I yelled her name and started to cross the street, but the tie-up had eased. Traffic started to flow. I tried to keep pace with her on my side of the street. I wanted to invite her to the party. The hosts knew her from way back, but the sidewalks on both sides were crowded. When I did get across 6th, she was gone. Aftermath. That night, I came home from the party and found the place completely cleaned up, with a thank-you note on the fridge, signed by all three kids, and I felt relieved, but also lost. The survivor party was on the Lower East Side. On my way back, I had gone by the East Village, walked up to 10th Street between B and C. People were out and about, bars were doing business, but there was still almost no vehicle traffic, and the block was very quiet. The building where we three had lived in increasing squalor and tension 35 years before was refinished, gentrified. I stood across the street looking. Maybe I willed his appearance. Jeff was there, in the corner of my eye, his face dead white, staring up, unblinking, at the light in what had been our windows. I turned towards him, and he disappeared. I looked aside, and he was there again, so lost and alone, the arms of his jacket soaked in blood. And I remembered us sitting around with the syringes and all of us making a pledge in blood to stick together as long as we lived, to which Jeff added, and even after. And I remembered how I had looked at him staring at Mags and knew she was looking at me, three sides of a triangle. The next day, Sunday, I went down to Mags' building, wanting very badly to talk to her. I rang the bell again and again. There was no response. I rang the super's apartment. She was a neighborhood lady, a lesbian around my age. I asked her about Mags. She disappeared. Last time anyone saw her was Sunday, 9-9. People in the building checked to make sure everyone was okay. No sign of her. I put a tape across her keyhole Wednesday. It's still there. I saw her just yesterday. Yeah? She looked skeptical. Well, there's a World Trade Center list of potentially missing persons, and her name's on it. You need to talk to them. This sounded to me like the landlord trying to get rid of her. For the next week, I called Mags a couple of times a day. At some point, the answering machine stopped coming on. I checked her building regularly. No sign of her. I asked Angelina if she remembered the two of us having dinner at her place on Wednesday 9-12. I was too busy staying busy so I wouldn't scream. I remember you, and I guess you were with somebody. But no, honey, I don't remember. Then I asked Marco if he remembered the phone call, and he did, but was much too involved by then with Terry and Eloise to be really interested. Around that time, I saw the couple who had wanted to take their kids down to Ground Zero. They were walking up 6th Avenue, the kids cranky and tired, the parents looking disappointed, like the amusement park turned out to be a ripoff. Life closed in around me. A short story collection of mine was being published at that very inopportune moment, and I needed to do some publicity work. I began seeing an old lover who'd come back to New York as a consultant for a company that had lost its offices and a big chunk of its staff when the North Tower fell. Mrs. Pirelli did not come home from the hospital, but went to live with her son in Connecticut. I made it a point to go by each of the Arab shops and listen to the owners say how awful they felt about what had happened and smile when they showed me pictures of their kids in Yankee caps and shirts. It was the next weekend that I saw Mags again. The university had gotten permission for the students to go back to the downtown dorms and get their stuff out. Marco, Terry, and Eloise came by the library and asked me to go with them, so I volunteered. Around noon on Sunday, 9-23, a couple of dozen kids and I piled into a university bus driven by Roger, a Jamaican guy who has worked for the university for as long as I have. The day before 9-11, these kids didn't much want old farts keeping them company, Roger had said to me. Then they all wanted their daddy. He led a convoy of jitneys and vans down the FDR Drive, then through quiet Sunday streets, then past trucks and construction vehicles. We stopped at a police checkpoint. Cop looked inside and waved us through. At the dorm, another cop told the kids they had an hour to get what they could and get out. Be ready to leave at a moment's notice if I tell you to, he said. Roger and I, as the senior members, stayed with the vehicles. The air was filthy. Our eyes watered. A few hundred feet up the street, a cloud of smoke still hovered over the ruins of the World Trade Center. Piles of rubble smoldered. Between the pit and us was a line of fire trucks and police cars with cherry tops flashing. Behind us, the kids hurried out of the dorm carrying boxes. I made them write the names on the boxes and noted in which van the boxes got stowed. I was surprised, touched even, the number of stuffed animals that were being rescued. Over the years, we've done some weird things to earn our pensions, I said to Roger. Like volunteering to come to the gates of hell? As he said that, flames sprouted from the rubble. Police and firefighters shouted and began to fall back. A fire department chemical tanker turned around, and the crew began unwinding hoses. Among the uniforms, I saw a civilian, a middle-aged woman in a sweater and jeans, carrying a sign. Mags walked toward the flames. I wanted to run to her. I wanted to shout, "Stop her!" Then I realized that none of the cops and firefighters seemed aware of her, even as she walked right past them. As she did, I saw another figure, thin, pale, in the suede jacket and bell-bottom pants. He held out his bloody hands, and together they walked through the smoke and flames into the hole in the city. Was that them? Marco had been standing beside me. I turned to him. Terry was back by the bus, watching Marco's every move. Eloise was gazing at Terry. be smarter than we were, I said, and Marco said, sure, with all the confidence in the world. There's a Hole in the City by Richard Bowes, read to you by the author.
And this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. Yes, Anthony, I bleeped up. There are three versions of that reading. One version was to get it to fit into a half-an-hour slot. And in that one, Rick talks a little faster. It's compressed. All the breaths are taken out. It's not one word is cut out, but it's the breathless version of There's a Hole in the City. Then there is the complete version, which is not what you just heard. And then there's the more than complete version, which is what you just heard. The more than complete version is the one which I failed to fully edit, where there's one point where I interrupted Rick during the reading and said, listen, try it like this, take that back and read it like this again. And that's what you all just heard. Now, I had...
It was good.
Anthony on Twitter, I want to give his last name out of permission, said, well, it's actually interesting to hear how you work with the reader, which made... I'm actually very, very proud of that reading, and so is Rick. We spent time putting that together. And so, but yeah, I mean, that should be the DVD extra. And there is a DVD extra of that, which was on the 10th anniversary of 9/11. We had a psychologist from John Jay on the air who deals with the psychology of mass calamity. How do people react to things like the Holocaust and 9/11 and mass trauma, and how well Rick incorporated that into the story. And I had a copy of that. That is what we often pitch on Hour of the Wolf as a premium during our fundraising drives with that extra, which I don't broadcast, just for the purpose of having an extra that people don't get on the air. You can get the story on the air, but there's that extra little thing that was on the air live on September 11th. Of 2011, 2 years ago. And Rick, Rick was reading last night at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, where I have a new feature. I do a raffle. I give away two items. We don't give it away. You buy. If you give any donation on your way in, you get a raffle ticket. And I've won from each writer. And I had a book from Rick plus the DVD, or rather the CD version, which is the clean, complete version, which is what I should have broadcast tonight. Instead, I simply whipped it off my hard drive, put it onto my USB drive, brought it here, and this fellow tweeted me saying, did you mean to play that version? It's like, no. And if you want to see my obscenities, they're on Twitter, Jim Freund at twitter.com. Sigh. So I apologize for that, but the story stands out. I still think it's one of the best things I have ever read about 9/11. Now, Thomas Pynchon, I understand, has a new novel, and even that's actually gotten a number of mixed reviews. But, yeah, if we want to split hairs and compare Rick Bowes' writing with Thomas Pynchon, I think that he'll enjoy the comparison. It's a deserved one. But as far as I'm concerned, given the reviews I've read of the Pynchon novel, Rick wins. So.
Great. All right.
And it's certainly the best science fiction. Or not science. Well, no, that's not true, because Pynchon really is speculative fiction. He really does deal with the beyond the world that we live in. He starts a novel with the sun going nova. Now, if that's not science fiction, what is? So, but no, it's Thomas Pynchon. It has to be.
You want to take some phone calls?
Yeah, absolutely. This is Hour of the Wolf, by the way, over WBAI in New York. I'm Jim Freund. With me is Lister, who is host of Burn Baby Burn Clapper. That is coming your way in just a few minutes. And, ooh, the phones are ringing.
Ooh.
So, good morning. You're on the radio.
Good morning.
Good morning, Robert.
Very few stories have ever made me cry. That does make me openly.
Wow. Yeah.
And
it's not because, you know, and the thing is that it's not really that soppy a story.
No.
It's just that, oh my God, the reveal of the story of what happened and that these people that our lead character has been dealing with have been dead for days.
Do you remember, James, where you were that Tuesday morning? I do.
I know exactly where I was.
Where were you, please?
Well, I was asleep, but the evening before, September 10th, 2001, I was at the New York Review of Science Fiction readings.
Oh, there was a reading that Monday night?
There was a reading that night, yes.
Mm-hmm. I was teaching that morning, and when all hell broke loose, they told us to take the kids out very quietly. And even though nobody knew what was happening, some of the kids actually began to cry.
Were you teaching at this campus?
High school. No. Yeah, no. I was teaching high school.
Oh, okay. Because I know that you were CUNY after that.
Yeah, but that was at night. And yeah. At the Graduate Center. I never taught where you are.
Oh, you're at the Graduate Center on 42nd Street.
Yeah. That's where the PhD students and the graduates.
Ah.
No. I just spent two days. I just spent today going to three memorials.
So you were CUNY, not City College?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. 80s. It was CUNY by that time, I think. 80s. Oh, yeah, yeah. But anyway,
did you know that City College was the first CUNY college? I didn't know that until
yes,
we moved here. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I remember, original. I went there when it was still City College of New York. There was no CUNY.
It is still City College of New York, but
part of the CUNY system, yeah.
Yeah, the CUNY system began with City College
City
in
college,
the 19th century.
Right.
Began in the 19th century.
Right. Mm. So, no. It was a Tuesday that I will never forget for the next 50 years, and it was just all. It's very strange. And the thing was that it was a hot Tuesday morning. It was, you know, above average temperature, and you could smell, James, the smoke, because I was standing straight.
Well, I saw it. I was in Brooklyn. I live in Brooklyn, we could see the smoke. And don't forget, BAI was 120 Wall Street.
Were you at Wall Street in those days?
Yeah.
I didn't realize it.
Yeah, we were there. We were breathing people.
How did you get in and out?
Walked.
Didn't they close off everything south of 14th Street for weeks?
Walked.
Oh, you walked. Oh.
Yeah, although actually, believe it or not, you could hitch a ride with army guys.
Oh.
It was the weirdest thing, is that here I am.
They pick you up?
And, yeah, they'd see me, you know, I would get a car service that would take me up to, like, Union Square. And from Union Square, I would start the long walk south. And there were army vehicles all over the place. And I just stuck out a thumb like a hitchhiker. And a Jeep passed me by. And soldiers with rifles on their backs flashed me a peace sign. And I thought, okay, the world has changed, man. Because I was the long hair that would, you know, give one or two finger salutes to soldiers
in previous years. No.
But no, I was basically, I found out that the easiest way to get around was to forget the cops. Cops were very little help. You went to the army and said, I have to get to 120 Wall Street. I work at a radio station down there. And more often than not, they'd say, if you wait about 15 minutes, somebody's going to do a tour.
Oh.
Because they were giving away right outside the station, which had not been a mall before but was turned into a mall right after 9/11, Outback Steakhouse had formed a free food for anybody with a legitimate shield that would be Army, police, or fire department.
You remember,
or rescue workers.
You remember the one picture that I will always have in my head, just thinking, near 9/11, there was a store that sold very expensive Italian Armani suits, which was then for at least a week or maybe more used as a triage center.
Well, yeah, I mean everybody except for one very famous chain of coffee stores
Chuck Full of Nut.
No, not that one. No, a different one. We're almost profiteering off of it, where everybody else was giving stuff away.
Oh, my God.
Anyhow, let's move on.
Yeah, one quick thing. Gravity comes out October 4th.
Okay, very good. Okay, take care. Have a good morning. Yeah, I knew it was coming up. Good morning. You're on the radio. Hello.
Hello, Jim.
How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. First of all, I want to thank you. I'm a blind person. I'm used to hearing people read, but I'll tell you, this was very wonderful to hear, especially because I know talking books and all that, they have monitors. So it gave me an idea of what it's like for someone who's reading as well as someone who's monitoring them. And so it was kind of fun to hear you.
Well, it's more than that because, yeah, thank you. But it's also that I like to hear the writer. I also work as an editor for podcasts that are done by a professional science fiction magazine. Those are recorded out in California with professional actors, with a director on site, and then it comes to me where I edit it. So that goes through three levels of quality,
production,
of production.
Production.
And, and there's a lot of this that can be found for free on the web.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
I highly recommend Clark's World magazine. And they have a weekly podcast, and it won the Hugo Award this year. And the one that I work for is LightspeedMagazine.com. And we put out one or two podcasts a week.
I wanted to ask you, thank you for that information. I wanted to ask you one question. I'm sure you've read it. What do you think about the Stephen King story, The Things They Left Behind?
I liked it.
Yeah.
I liked it. I thought it was a good story.
Yeah, it was a good little short story. I thought it was really
And I'm very snobbish about short stories. I like Stephen King's short stories more than I like his epic novels.
I do, too. I'll tell you what. Read A Tight Place or something like that.
And one of his best stories to date is The Body. Which was made into a movie called Stand By Me. And it's not science fiction or fantasy or anything. It's a sort of autobiography of when he was 10 years old.
Hmm. Oh, and where do you find that story?
The Body, I don't remember what
you
collection.
You don't know the
anthology? Collection. No, I don't.
Collection. No.
It's been anthologized many times, and it's in one of his original collections. Probably, and I'm making this up, it's a good guess, there's probably a book called The Best of Stephen King. And it's not a long story, so should be relatively easy to find.
Okay, no, oh, thank you so much. But I'll tell you, yeah, if you want to read a really suspenseful and strange story, A Tight Place, it's in After Sunset.
Okay, that one I don't know.
Yeah, I think, yes, After Sunset Stories.
Okay.
Yeah, which is, he also has The Things They Left Behind is in there.
Ah, yeah, well, that one I read online, I think, when it was first published.
And what did you say was the name of the magazine that you, are these, you have to pay for these, or?
No, these are free.
And what is the name of the one you work for that they can get podcasts?
Lightspeed Magazine. And there's a story comes out a week. There's actually two stories a week, and one of the two stories always has a professional podcast.
And you can just do Lightspeed.com.
You just, it's LightspeedMagazine.com. There's also NightmareMagazine.com, which only puts out one story every, or rather two stories every 2 weeks. And it's the same editor and the same producers, which is Skyboat Media with... Stefan Rudnicki and Gabrielle DeCure. But, I mean, the people who I have edited are Alex Hyde-White and Claire Bloom and John Rubinstein. You know,
oh,
we're not...
Oh, my goodness.
And Stefan himself is one of the best, and Gabrielle, are among the best narrators of audiobooks out there.
And the other one is Clark's World.
Clark's World. One word. Edited by Neil Clark. And the reader for most of those is Kate Baker. And she's simply wonderful. I'm sorry?
C-L-A-R-K-S?
No, it's got an E. C-L-A-R-K-E-S.
And World.
And World, one word.
Oh,
So it's clarksworld.com, and he adds music to his podcast, and Kate is simply a fabulous reader.
And you can just listen to these. You don't have to download them. You can just listen to them.
Yes, they stream.
They stream. Oh, fantastic. Oh, thank you so much. I have a great evening, and thank you for the story. Do some more of that. That's wonderful.
That way we do this every week.
We do it every week.
I mean, occasionally I won't have a story. I mean, last week we had a radio drama.
I heard that.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, you know. So,
I was a radio person, and I turned it on. I said, why is there a radio? And I thought,
because Hour of the Wolf has been on this station since 1972, and this is what we do on Hour of the Wolf.
I'm going to, thank you.
He said right. Snottily.
It's not too late. You're still on.
Yeah.
And they're not thinking of taking you off, are they?
No.
Good.
He said in his best Australian accent.
They may
screw around with time slots and things like that, but I will be on the schedule somewhere.
Because I give constantly, and you know.
Yeah.
All right, my dear. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Have a great morning.
That was a great call.
Bye. And you too, sir.
All right.
Okay, listener. Okay.
Yes, yes.
Good morning. Thank you again. And hi there, you're on the radio. What? No, you're not. You're a dial tone. Why am I putting you on the air if you're a dial tone?
That's the signature of WBAI.
Oh, God, please don't say that. Bite your tongue.
Next
thing, it's going to be what they call euphemistically white noise, which is that sound that you hear of the transmitter turned off. And, oh, God, you know, we go into fundraising mode soon.
No, when?
Absolutely. October.
Ooh.
But yeah, we're going to see how it goes because we have a different person running it and a different sensibility behind it. But we're also, I mean, we have to hear Andrew Phillips, the PD, tell it.
Yeah.
We're going to have like $50,000 days.
Ooh.
In order to make it.
Yeah.
Which is what he's used to making in California.
Sure, sure.
And I don't know that we had $50,000 days when he was the program director 20 years ago.
Yeah.
But we did a lot better than we're doing now. Good morning, you're on the radio. Hello.
Hello.
Hi there, you're on the air.
Oh, Jim.
Yeah.
I hereby declare summer of 3-2-1. A month of Frederick Pohl on the Golden Age of Radio.
Far out. So I played the Space Merchants last week. What are you playing this week?
Well, we have the Map Makers.
Great.
We have, God, now you're going to make me try to find it quickly on the...
The Merchants, okay.
Well, we got the Space Merchants, I believe.
Yeah, but the Merchants of Venus.
That's not him, is it?
Yes, it is.
Merchant of Venus?
The Merchant of Venus.
Yeah.
Well, no,
it's a semi-sequel to The Space Merchants.
Yeah.
And the Merchant of Venus was actually I think The Space Merchants was him and C.M. Kornbluth, and The Merchant of Venus is him alone, and he may or may not have done it under one of his many, many, many pseudonyms.
Because there is a Merchant of Venus, but it's not credited under his name.
Yeah.
Well, now he
wrote it.
Another one.
Yeah.
I need to look at your Facebook page where I posted the other two titles.
Right.
I can't find them right now.
Yeah, well, it's on my Facebook page.
Yes.
But
there are two other X-1s by Pohl, directly written by under his own name.
There was one with the word tunnel in it?
Tunnel Under the World. I played that on Sunday.
Oh, okay.
So it's in the archives.
So it's in the archive.
One of my favorite X-1s.
Yeah.
Map Makers, and then there were two much later ones.
Well, the one that I am looking for is The Gold at the Starbow's End.
Well, I'm not aware of an adaptation of that on the radio.
Oh, I'm well aware of an adaptation of that on the radio. I produced it.
I see. But you don't have it.
I don't have it. And I can tell you who's in it, everybody who was on staff in 1976. Including the manager and, you know, whoever was PD that week.
We also have The Haunted Corpse. There's another one.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
And finally, the final one is, They did the Haunted Corpse over in Otago.
They did like, yeah, they did like three productions of that, didn't they?
The Haunted Corpse.
Plan to eliminate atomic warfare with an experiment in time travel.
Okay. So, for those listeners who don't know, when is the Golden Age of Radio broadcast, Max?
Well, that would be Sunday nights from 7 to 9.
Yeah.
And Eastern Time, New York. Sunday nights 7 to 9 over WBAI New York and at WBAI.org. Produced as a service by Max Schmid.
Also, it's one of my favorite shows. You know that. I listen fanatically.
Yeah, so have you asked for Mass backwards? We'll talk about that off the air.
There are so many pole stories that I may divert some of them to the internet show.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, and he was such a wonderful guy. He really was.
He looked a little like H.P. Lovecraft, so I saw an old picture of him from the 30s.
Yeah, do you have any Fred Pohl stuff from the Long John Neville show? He was a regular guest on Long John.
None of that seems to survive.
Hey, when are you going to bring back the Shadow? Bring back the Shadow.
A lost episode of the Shadow by, that comic book writer. Give me
Alfred Bester.
Yes, Alfred. Yeah. I should have just picked up the script sitting in front of me.
All right.
Yeah, there you go.
All right.
We're performing in Baltimore a week from today,
actually. Ooh, great.
I don't know if we're going to get a good enough recording to play on the radio, and at the moment we're...
I'll loan you my... I have an extra recorder. I'll loan it to you. Right. Are you coming to the staff meeting tonight?
The problem is that the acoustics in this hall that we're playing in are not very good.
Now, this is a Zoom H4N. It should do it.
Yeah.
Well, Max, don't forget, only the Shadow knows.
And Lamont. Don't forget him.
Yeah.
Listen... Lister's on in under 60 seconds.
Oh, he's there.
Yeah.
Well, who do you think you're talking to?
Remind him to play background briefing.
I will. I got it. It's in my hands. I got it. It's in my marijuana
He
hands.
May not be here, but he is still the ops director. Thank you, Max.
No problem. Thanks,
I'm my ops person at this hour.
The ops person not on duty at this moment.
Exactly. Well, we miss you here.
Miss you, Max. Great hearing you.
Bring back the overnights. Bring back Al Jazeera.
Yeah, well, don't know about Al, but bring back the overnights. We have to have somebody here.
Yeah, I agree. We all agree, but we can't afford it at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. I'll put another shrimp on the bobby. Will I see you tonight?
I'm working.
Oh, okay.
But I will say this. It was the first time I actually got to hear that story all the way through, more or less.
Except for the guy interrupting, yeah. Okay, I gotta get off.
Okay,
the dreadlocks have come out.
Nails of silver.
Yep, it's there.
All right.
Good morning, Max.
Good evening.
This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Rick Bose has finished reading, and so Lister's clothes are all coming off. And my theme is already over. Well, it's 3:00. I try to end on time. So, let me just say thank you all for listening. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper. Visit me on Facebook. There's an Hour of the Wolf group, and there's ourwolf.com, where you can also send me email. Have a wonderful morning, and stay tuned.
When I leave, you can remember I said with the last words on my lips that I am a revolutionary. And you're gonna have to keep on saying that. You're gonna have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
a bitch. The red, white, and blue will spit on you.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth that's on the way I see it? Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system works to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right in this writing. The Constitution, yo, that's an illusion. Huh, suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. We'll be right back.
American dream a nightmare. I want the people to wake up to the lies, the pigs, makeup, imperialistic swans that I grind into bacon bits. Call the bits, cause I ain't taking. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison, cause I'm anti attack. The flag, I rag it and snag it and drag it and rip it to shreds. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded, cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece up to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. Let's find the people who hate this shit. These are the places we'll hit.
Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, can't forget Korea, Beirut, can't forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talk about uptown Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy. Never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx. Yeah.
My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangled. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home. Free, boom, it's the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I torch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn it.
Girl, come let me discombobulate your parts. love you, can I do my thing? Girl, I love the vibe you bring. Open up and let me in, we could do most anything. Tell me to get a love it, I know say right, I know you is a part of me plan. I notice by your fingers, say you wear a wedding band. Nobody thinks that this is just a one night stand. Don't think I'm gonna look you for your slam. I tell you, girl, on top of how you look, you know you have sex appeal. You're like a priceless gem where every man wants to steal. Expressing my emotion, got to tell you how I feel. So baby, come and let me know the deal. Now come here, mister. Baby, can I do my thing? Girl, I love the vibe you bring. Open up and let me in, and we could do most anything. Tell me, do you like a swing? Baby, can I do my thing? Girl, I love the vibe you bring. Open up and let me in, and we could do most anything. Tell me, do you like a swing?
Ding 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 ding.
Michael Rose,
and you're listening to Clappers
all night long. I know I'm gonna put you on cloud nine, girl. Or we practice or we preach. As much as we practice, we know we teach.
Well, tell me if you know here. How the regular lover way I run things this year. New tunes, the boss of me, I be rich this year. No need to fear. Girl, if you don't want this to love, I put your finger on the ear, I love you all. And I even like the ranchy way that you talk. You the kind of girl that turn the fellas all a star. Hound dogs a bar. Girl, come let me discombobulate your parts. Then come in, mister.
Hey.
Baby, can I do my thing?
Yo. Listeners back right here where it belongs. 99 Cinco. List alive. 99 Cinco. On a Thursday. 9 minutes after 3 o'clock right here at WBAI 99 Cinco. You know, Pacifica Radio at its very best. The new WBAI.